In this episode of the Motor City Hypnotist Podcast, we are going to talk about the history. It's Halloween. I thought we'd do something kind of scary, but we're going to talk about the history of insane asylums.
I'm so scared.
We're just going to talk about how they started, why, and kind of a brief history, but yeah, kind of how they came to be and honestly, kind of what happened to them. So yeah, stick around. Pretty interesting. And as usual, giving away a bunch of free stuff. Hang around. We will be right back.
Get ready for the Motor City Hypnotist, David R. Wright, originating from the suburbs of Detroit, Michigan. He has hypnotized thousands of people from all over the United States. David R. Wright has been featured on news outlets all across the country and is the clinical director of an outpatient mental health and hypnosis clinic located just south of Detroit, where he helps people daily using the power of hypnosis. Welcome, the Motor City Hypnotist, David R. Wright.
What is going on, my friends? This is David Wright, the Motor City Hypnotist, and we're back with another episode of the Motor City Hypnotist Podcast.
Welcome, sir.
Welcome to you. That is Matt Fox. That's the other voice you hear.
Yay.
We're here in the Podcast Nation Southfield Studios.
Yeah, we're here.
The Palatial Studios, as we found out.
Amy says hi.
Oh, hi, Amy. My sister Amy says hello.
Yes. Hi, Amy.
Amy, hope you're doing well. Hope you and the family are well. And yeah, here we are, hanging out, having a little beverage.
Cocktails.
Cheers. Cheers, Matt.
Cheers, sir. Happy
cheers to Basil Hayden.
So you do record Fridays at 5, mm-hmm. and this is kind of like the start of the weekend for you and I.
It is, yes.
So that's
we just start a little bit early.
Yeah.
It is after 5, so technically.
That's 5 o'clock somewhere.
Yeah. Yeah. You know,
you're in your car listening whenever. It might be 10 a.m. in the morning.
That's true, too. If you're listening to the podcast on the podcast mm-hmm. provider, you could be listening to this anytime. So, mm-hmm. so yeah, we are here. And let me tell you where you can find me. My website is MotorCityHypnotist.com. On there, you'll find all kinds of cool stuff. Here's the big thing. I was just telling Matt before we went on today, I'm already getting inquiries for shows for next spring prom and grad season.
Yay!
From a lot of high schools.
Yep.
I just had another inquiry today. So if that's something that you might be interested in, get your request in because schedule's filling up.
Yep. Calendar is filling up.
It's already started. So in those grad night, there's only a limited amount of weekends for prom and grad.
Correct.
So, you know, those fill up pretty quickly. So, yeah, if you've ever thought about or you want to have this for your school, if you're a parent in a committee, maybe you're one of the admins at a school that's helping with those arrangements, get a hold of me quickly because those spots go quick.
Mm.
So, yeah, check that out on the website. You can find me there. You can send me a message through the website. You can also hit me up on social media. My social media links are Facebook and YouTube, which are both Motor City Hypnotist. And Twitter, Instagram, and Snapchat, which are all Motor City Hypno.
Awesome.
So, yeah, you can catch me on any of those.
That's H-Y-P-N-O.
H-Y-P-N-O. That is right. And as usual, as we do every show, we're giving away free stuff, including a free hypnosis guide that's always available. It's a, I don't know, page and a half PDF that kind of explains hypnosis. If you're the first time here, grab that because it's a good information thing for you.
Mm-hmm.
Just kind of understand what it is, how it works, why it might not work. It's all kinds of cool stuff on there, and it's totally free. So, yeah, you can just click on the link, and it will take you right to that page, and you can download that for yourself.
Do it.
Awesome. So, yeah, Matt, how you been? You been good?
Yeah. We haven't seen each other in a couple Fridays.
Mm-hmm.
Life goes on. Life moves on. It does. Been okay. Work is kicking my butt, which is a good thing. It's keeping me sane. Yep. Work is definitely keeping me on the up and up.
Yeah, it's good. Yeah, I'm my wife was out of town last week, so my son and I kind of hung out for the weekend.
Did you party hardy, Marty?
Not really. Went to B-Dubs. I mean, that was the highlight of our week.
What did you have for dinner that night?
Oh my God, I told you I had the Blazin' Wings.
Yeah,
the Blazin' Carolina Reaper wings. And I love hot stuff. And it was painful because you know it's hot, mm-hmm. and I like that. But I've never had this experience before, and I'll try to explain this as gently as I can. But typically, it's not an issue for me in the bathroom afterwards. And I'm not talking, again, I want to put this delicately. Let's say this. If you've ever seen the Green Mile and Tom Hanks' issue with urinating, yeah.
That's what it was like?
I don't know what happened. It's never happened to me before, but it felt like fire.
I think it was the cayenne pepper in that.
It's Carolina Reaper, so got to be, you know. But yeah, it's weird because I've never had that happen before. It's just a very odd thing.
Oh, yeah, at least you had a good experience.
So I did.
With the food.
And it was one time and it was done. So, you know, I didn't have to suffer with it.
So one time only and one and done?
Or get healed by John Coffey.
There you go.
Yeah. Although that would have been nice right at that moment.
You got it, boss.
So yeah, we're here, we're hanging out. Might as well talk about a winner now, winner of the week, since that was not a winning thing.
Okay, any sponsors for this week?
Oh, let's do that first.
Yeah.
See, I've been off for a week. Matt's got to keep me on track here.
I'm doing what I can.
Our sponsor is Empower Your Mind for Success, A Hypnotic Guide. That is my new book that has been out for about 2 months now. It is currently available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and really any bookstore that you can find. Mm-hmm. If they don't happen to have it on the shelf, they can definitely order it.
Correct.
They have availability to order through Ingram Spark. That's the company that provides books to bookstores. So you can either order it on Amazon, or if you want to go to your local bookstore and then help promote a local business or support a local business, mm-hmm. just ask them to order it. They can get it for you. Empower Your Mind for Success, A Hypnotic Guide. Mm-hmm. Quick story, and I'm going to out myself on this. So, you know, the book process, even after it was written, it goes through editing at least 3-4 rounds.
Right.
Formatting goes through, and that gets looked at a couple of times. The cover has to get formatted and made sure it's correct. So mm-hmm. I don't know how many people have seen this book up to this point. My son comes to me the other day, looks at the back cover, and he goes, "Oh, there's a typo right here in the back cover."
Oh, no!
I've not seen it. I've never noticed. Nobody's brought it up. Nobody's noticed it. And it's a small typo on the back cover in my bio.
Oh, bummer.
Yeah, not a big deal. It's fixable, but
Did they spell your last name with an R instead of a W?
No. Most of the major things are right. It's just in the narrative as far as my bio. There's one word. It says the one that says he performs stage hypnosis shows. It says staged with a D. Staged hypnosis shows.
Oh, so it's like planned.
Well, yeah, that sounds doesn't it sound odd?
Yeah, like, it kind of does.
I'm staging it to like I'm trying to fool somebody.
But, right.
But anyway, that's off. You know, that happens though. Yeah. I'm telling you, I read all the time, and I don't think I've ever read a book that didn't have a typo in it. And a lot of my colleagues who've done books, they say, you know what? That's going to happen. It happens to everyone. It happens to Stephen King. It happens to huge authors.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. Something's going to get
not
through.
Not a big deal. So anyway, pick up Empower Your Mind for Success, A Hypnotic Guide. Again, you can get it on Amazon. I'll leave the link to the Amazon link in the show notes. If you can just click there, it'll take you right to the page. Mm-hmm. Pick it up. You can get it on paperback or on Kindle version. And if you do read it, which I would hope you would, that would help me out, please leave a review, because the more reviews that are left on Amazon, of course, the more people see it, and then they can know that, hey, I should get this, because right. people have reviewed it and they like it. So yeah, that's what today's episode is brought to you by, Empower Your Mind for Success, A Hypnotic Guide. Now we can do a winner of the week.
Now we can do winner of the week.
Can. Yeah. Yeah, let's hit it.
That's how winning is done.
This is a cool story. One, I love music. And this story is about a guitar, believe it or not.
Okay. Does it gently
weep? I dabble
weep?
In guitar.
Does it gently weep?
It may have. I don't know.
Okay.
So, you know who Randy Bachman is?
Yes.
Yes. Okay. So back in 1976, when Canadian rock star Randy Bachman of the Guess Who and Bachman Turner Overdrive.
Mm-hmm. BTO.
Yep. Discovered his favorite guitar had been stolen from his Toronto hotel room while he was on tour, he cried all night.
He gently weeped.
Yep. He I don't think he gently weeped. He definitely weeped, though.
Yeah.
Having done so let me tell you the story of how he got this guitar. Having done every odd job on the block as a boy to afford the $400 1957 Gretsch 6120 Chet Atkins model in Western Orange.
To be specific.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a 1957 Gretsch 6120 Chet Atkins model. Its departure left a hole in his heart that would only be filled 35 years later.
Okay.
When an internet sleuth managed to track down this distinctive instrument and found it in Japan.
Oh, Jesus.
So listen to this. Bachman, who used the guitar to write hits like Taking Care of Business and American Woman, told CBC News that he and Neil Young would spend hours drooling over it in the window of a Winnipeg music store. I'm sure he's talking about when he was a kid, when he got it.
Sure.
So we're going back to his to him getting this. So I have a paper route where you like make $2 a week delivering paper, and you mow a lawn for $1, and you babysit someone, you get $1. You're working at a car wash, and you get 50 cents an hour. This way, this was way, way back, he told CNN. So to save $400 was a big, big deal.
Absolutely.
Yeah, as a kid.
That's a lot of diapers.
Then it was stolen after the road manager didn't use the 12-foot-long tow chain to lock it up, as was Bachman's custom. Mm-hmm. And in the aftermath, he would buy hundreds of Gretsch guitars trying to replicate the magic of the one he lost.
My goodness.
Okay, so fast forward 3 decades. A fan of Bachman was watching some Guess Who videos on YouTube when he came across one of Bachman and his son explaining the story of the guitar theft.
Mm-hmm.
Being a fan of solving puzzles, he decided to see if he could locate the missing Gretsch by comparing high-res imagery of the stolen guitar with listings of the same model around the world.
Huh.
I probably went through maybe 300 Gretsch images, and I got pretty good at it, so I could see them, and I could know right away that it wasn't the one. William Long is the fan in question, he told CNN. He tracked it down to a Tokyo vintage music store, but looking over their website, found out it had been sold. Comparing footage of a particular Japanese guitarist to that of Bachman playing the song Looking Out for Number One on Dutch television.
Oh my goodness.
Long concluded it was the same instrument due to the distinctive pattern in the grain of wood.
Oh, jeez.
When Long finally got in contact with Bachman and explained the situation, Bachman said it was like being hit in the face with a shovel. Man, my guitar, I was in tears. It's just unbelievable because I've been searching for this forever and basically gave up on it, he recounted.
Hmm.
So, the Japan connection. Coco, Bachman's Japanese daughter-in-law, reached out to Takeshi, the guitar's then-owner, to explain the situation. So they tracked it down to the owner, who owns his guitar now.
Wow.
So Coco translated a Zoom meeting between the artist and Takeshi, and Takeshi assured Bachman he was not a thief. He just bought it from a store.
Yeah.
But of course, said Bachman, noting Takeshi had only just been born the night the Gretsch was taken from the hotel room.
Right.
So he's a younger kid. Takeshi agreed to return the guitar if Bachman could find one just like it, a difficult task as fewer than 40 remain from the 57 lot code. I don't know why the guy just didn't said,
you know what?
Just give me a new guitar.
Right.
Here's your guitar. I want you to have this.
Right. Replace
my guitar so I can have one.
Right.
Fortunately, having been deprived of such a model for so long, Bachman had already amassed a Rolodex of distributors and collectors into which he dove until he found a guitar which he described as likely made on the same bench.
Okay.
So he said, this is Takeshi, the guy who had the guitar.
Mm-hmm.
When I first strummed this guitar at the music shop in Tokyo, it spoke to me like no other guitar I've ever played. I knew I felt it was destiny. I immediately impulsively purchased it. I'm so honored and proud to be the one who can finally return the stolen guitar to its owner, the rock star Mr. Bachman, who has been searching for it for nearly half a century.
And Takeshi, that was your destiny to do with that
absolutely.
Guitar. All right.
Takeshi, you did the right thing. Because he could have said, no, it's mine.
Yeah.
And I feel grateful for this miracle happening in both of our lives. Once the country eases COVID restrictions, Bachman's going to travel to Japan to make the swap and have a jam session with Takeshi in a Tokyo club.
Huh.
Bachman is also considering turning the story into a mini documentary and will probably write some music about the whole saga in the upcoming album he's preparing with his son under the somewhat expected handle of Bachman and Bachman.
Huh.
the same name as the YouTube channel they share.
Interesting.
Yeah, that's a story.
Huh.
So Bachman had, I got to go back to the, because the title of it, the whole thing is just how in the world, 1976.
Right.
And this Gretsch 6120 Chet Atkins model guitar is gone. And to think it even still exists or is in one piece mm-hmm. is even just
that's
beyond
why he,
me.
That's why he gave up on it, because
yeah,
it was 1976.
I mean, that it could have been destroyed a year later or just thrown in a garbage heap or something.
Right.
It's just that it still exists is a miracle in and of itself.
Well,
and that he was this guy on the internet. I got to get back to that guy's name.
Well, it looks like they took care of business. See what I did there?
Yeah, I did see what you did there.
See what I did there?
Yes. Well, I got to find the...
Oh, the sleuth?
Yeah, the sleuth. William Long.
All right. William Sleuth?
William Long. So,
William
so
Long.
There are a lot of winners here. Takeishi, William Long, Randy Bachman,
uh-huh.
and this Gretsch guitar.
Yep. Winners of the week?
Yeah. Yeah. It's just a great story. You know, after, 35 years, found his long-lost guitar.
It's like finding your dog that disappeared 5 years
yeah,
ago.
Yeah, and they just, wander in and
right.
find you, or you find them.
Right. What was that, Homeward Bound? Is that what that movie was called?
I didn't see it, but...
Oh, it's the dog, the cat, and I think it was another dog.
Is that the one where they talk?
Yeah.
No, I didn't see it.
Okay.
Yeah. Anyway, awesome. Bachman, taking care of business.
That's how winning is done.
It's a good story. I did know they. I forgot about American Woman also.
Yeah.
That was the original. And
Lenny Kravitz covered it.
Yep. Lenny Kravitz covered it later.
Yes, he did. So, back to it.
Mm-hmm.
I love the drop.
Oh, yeah.
So, back to it.
There we go.
So, you're going to scare the hell out of me? Is that what you're going to do?
I don't know if it's scary, but it's very... Okay, so let me preface this. It's kind of a Halloween thing, and honestly, I like Halloween as a holiday.
Okay.
I think it's fun. I like scary movies. I like, again, my favorite author is Stephen King, so that's kind of,
Yeah, okay.
Little freaky. But I think people have always had this fascination with asylums, like insane asylums, mm-hmm. as they used to be called. I mean, if you've seen the movie One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest or any other of these historical type movies
like
where
Stripes.
They show these asylums.
Like Stripes.
Stripes.
I'm kidding.
I can be your big toe. Yeah.
Sorry. Lighten up. Go on.
What do you have, a 68-week training program? Which is perfect for me. So an asylum might be perfect for you, but maybe not. So I wanted to talk about the history of how did these things come about and how... Like, how accurate are some of these movie portrayals of, like, Nicholson in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest?
Right.
Is that, were asylums like that? I mean, did they do these crazy things to...
Shutter Island.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's another one of those yep. asylum-type movies.
Yep. If you've watched American Horror Story,
mm-hmm.
Asylum was one of their seasons.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of TV and movies that kind of reflect these kind of I don't know, these crazy or weird or bizarre things that happen in these asylums. But we're going to talk about it.
Okay.
So very early American communities, put it this way, and people, I want to preface this and frame this, that mental illness is not a new thing. It existed throughout humanity.
Mm-hmm.
It just wasn't understood
right.
like it is nowadays. Just like most of our big medical issues that have been in existence for since humanity started, and we just understand more about it now. So in early American communities, people who were mentally ill, that they just had to be taken care of by their families. Mm-hmm. There was nobody to see. There was no place to go. And oftentimes, most of the time, they would end up in jails
right.
because the family couldn't do anything with them. In early days, mental illness was thought to be caused by a moral or spiritual failing of some type.
Mm.
So it was often treated with punishment and shame, being jailed and people just got rid of them because they couldn't deal with them. So as areas grew and places got more densely settled and the population grew, mental illness became one of the number one social issues, and they started making institutions to house these people.
AKA asylums.
Yeah, which eventually became the term asylums. Mm-hmm. So the first, I guess the first documented case of a place was in 1752.
Really?
The Quakers in Philadelphia were the first in America to make an organized effort to care for the mentally ill. The newly opened Pennsylvania Hospital in Philadelphia provided rooms in the basement. Now, I'm going to go through some of this information, and it's not going to shock you, but it's going to be like, man, how barbaric. Because, again, we're talking 1752.
I mean, they had basements back then?
Yeah, they had basements.
Okay.
They provided rooms in the basement complete with shackles attached to the walls to house a small number of mentally ill patients.
I'm assuming they were
Oh! Great Odin's Raven!
And there were concrete walls or stoned brick,
so.
Stoned walls.
I mean, right? I can't imagine that the basements were very nice.
Right.
You know?
Right.
I you know.
Jeez.
How are you going to wipe a table with this little? It's not even wet.
I was thinking about a wet basement, but yeah, that's
enough.
Fine. Yeah. So within a year or two, the press for admissions required additional space and a ward was opened beside the hospital. Eventually, a new Pennsylvania Hospital for the Insane, that was what it was called, opened in a suburb in 1856 and remained open under different names until 1998.
Wow.
Yeah.
The same place from 1752.
Same place from 1752 to 1998.
Wow.
Under different names later.
But can you imagine the history in that building and how spooky it would have been to walk through that place?
Yeah, and you know, this is a business for a lot of these old buildings that were built as asylums or hospitals. Mm-hmm. That I told you, my wife and I, a year ago, we did a tour of Eloise Hospital here in the Detroit area.
Right.
I think it's technically, is it Livonia? It's not right in Detroit, but
Plymouth.
I think it's right at Plymouth Road and I think anyway, it's in that area. But this is a fascination for a lot of people. They, you know, they go on these ghost tours and these tours of these old buildings that used to be hospitals. So let's go move on from that to 1773. So it was a little bit later.
So 1752 was the first one.
Yep.
So now
1773, which is, you know, I don't know, 21 years.
19 years.
Yeah, 19 years.
21 years.
I'm not good with math.
21 years.
No! Don't shut me up!
It's after 5 on a Friday. I stopped mathing at 5.
No, yeah,
so.
I don't do math at all. I just try to figure it out.
Da-da-da-da, like this in the background. What the fuck is it with you?
So in 1773, to deal with mentally disturbed people who were causing problems in the community, the Virginia legislature provided funds to build a small hospital in Williamsburg. Over the years, the hospital grew in size as needs arose, but remained within the historic area of the city until the mid-20th century, when a new hospital was built in a suburb. Today, it is known as the Eastern State Hospital. 1792, again, another almost, you know, little less than 20 years later, the New York hospital opened a ward for curable insane patients, curable in quotes.
Curable.
In 1808, a freestanding medical facility was built nearby for the humane treatment of the mentally ill. And in 1821, a larger facility called the Bloomingdale Asylum was built in what is now the Upper West Side. In 1894, it was moved further away to the suburb of White Plains and is currently under operation as the Payne Whitney Westchester Hospital.
My goodness.
So a lot of these asylums were built and ended up evolving into hospitals as time went on.
Our friend Alan Benson checked in.
Oh, Alan, what's going on,
and
Alan?
He says, "Happy Friday, gents. Happy Taco Friday."
Absolutely. It's always Taco Friday.
He said, hey, my wife and I watched the Netflix series Ratchet while back. It was based on Nurse Ratchet character.
Yep.
It was so off the wall but enjoyable as hell. With a side note, though, I have a question. Do you see a noticeable spike in clients during the winter months? I would think so, but never really got a solid answer.
Okay, so typically, I'll give you a general because I know it doesn't apply to everyone, but with our facility, typically there's a spike in the end of September going into this month, into October.
Mm. Is that because of the weather changing? A
couple of reasons for that. Because summer, sometimes people get off track because kids are home from school, schedules change, you know, and once fall starts, people feel like they're back into a typical or normal schedule, per se. And it's also when kids get back to school, and within that first few weeks of September, you start seeing issues if kids are having issues.
Okay.
Once they're back in school, parents start seeing issues. So as far as the under 18, it increases in September, beginning of October. It typically also increases for the parents because now they're dealing with things that they have to, you know, address and handle, which causes conflict in couples, especially if the kids are having issues. That tends to flow over into the relationship with the parents.
Wow.
So typically we'll see an uptick in the end of September into this month. Then it will kind of kind of subside during December because everybody gets busy. Christmas, people get overwhelmed. They don't have time. And then we see another uptick near the end of January once December and holiday rolls and the people are back in a normal schedule again. And then again, we have a dip once summer starts because people start doing vacations and changing their schedule. So for our office, that's how it rolls. So I would say, yeah, but probably during the fall winter season, we do see an increase. It drops off just for a little bit during the holidays and then picks back up in January.
Okay. So has anyone ever had to check into one of these places because of that?
Yes. Well, not these places.
Not those places.
Not asylums. Okay. But yeah, and oftentimes with anybody who's done mental health work or therapy or social work over the years, it's the odds are there that you're going to have to admit somebody to the hospital at some point. It's just a fact because some people need more than what we can provide, which is outpatient therapy. Right.
And it's not always inevitable, but
Inevitable, but sometimes people who suffer from schizophrenia or severe bipolar disorder, at some point they need more than a weekly session with a therapist to address that. They need medication intervention. They need to, and honestly, a lot of times they will need to be hospitalized because they don't have 24-hour supervision or care.
Right.
And oftentimes these people will have hallucinations, delusions, might be suicidal. So they need more than what an outpatient session once a week is going
to provide. And it could be their meds just need to be adjusted
or evaluated. A lot of times people have never been on meds. They've never addressed it.
Ah.
So just we'll stay on that tangent just for a moment. So typically, as far as like severe mental illness, such as schizophrenia and bipolar disorder, they typically manifest in the mid to late 20s. That's generalized. It can be sooner, it can be later. That's the majority of people exhibit symptoms of that in their mid to late 20s.
Could that be like a catalyst or start of that for it could be postpartum that could have made them start to go down that aisle?
There could be a precipitating factor to it. A lot of times it is genetic. A lot of people who have history of these mental illnesses in family are more likely to have these.
Okay.
They've done studies that if you have people in your family who have been diagnosed and are schizophrenic, that you're more likely to have that as opposed to somebody who doesn't have it in their family.
Okay. Okay.
So
thanks for that.
Yeah, absolutely.
And thank you for the question,
Alan. Thanks, Alan. Oh, Alan. And by the way,
the fuck are you doing?
He's having tacos.
Yes, he's having tacos.
Yeah, that's awesome. So yeah, we talked about 1792, the New York Hospital, in 1817. So you see, we're not progressing very quickly here through the history. In Philadelphia, the Asylum for the Relief of Persons Deprived. Oh boy, I got to read this whole thing. I haven't even finished half of the title.
Oh my goodness!
This is it was called this, the Asylum for the Relief of Persons Deprived of the Use of Their Reason.
Can you say that three times fast?
No, I can't. I don't know what I was.
What in blazes are you talking about?
Honestly, I don't know. I'm just reading it. The Asylum for the Relief of Persons Deprived of the Use of Their Reason.
Wow.
Was opened under Quaker auspices as a private mental hospital. It continues to serve this function to this day as the Friends Hospital, and that's in Philadelphia.
Wow.
In 1824, the Eastern Lunatic Asylum.
Okay.
First time we've had a lunatic in the title of an asylum.
Right, right.
The Eastern Lunatic Asylum was opened in Lexington, Kentucky as the first mental institution west of the Appalachian Mountains. It still operates today under the name Eastern State Hospital.
Hmm.
So that was 1824. So we're looking at, not even 100 years yet. By 1890, every state had built one or more publicly supported mental hospitals, which all expanded in size as the country's population increased. Mm. Makes sense. As your population increases, you're going to have more sick people, whatever it is, whether it's physical or mental illness. By the mid-20th century, the hospitals housed over 500,000 patients, but began to diminish in size as new methods of treatment became available.
We're going to talk about that, right?
We are. We're going to see where things kind of switched routes or switched gears. So let's go ahead to 1907. Indiana is the first of more than 30 states to enact a compulsory sterilization law, allowing the state to prevent procreation of confirmed criminals, idiots, imbeciles, and rapists. That's the law from 1907.
Okay. Wow.
By 1940, 18,552 mentally ill people are surgically sterilized.
18,552 were surgically sterilized.
Yep. By 1940. From 1907 to 1940.
That's wild.
I know. That's I'm telling you, these things will blow your mind. And when you see these movies, it's hearkening back to these days when
What were you thinking?
I know.
Boy, that escalated quickly. Yeah. I mean, that really got out of hand fast.
It gets better, or worse, in many ways. In 1936, Dr. Walter Freeman and his colleagues James Watt performed the first prefrontal lobotomy.
In front of an entire, he was at the bottom of that staircase and people were watching from above, right?
It's hard to say.
I don't know.
They performed their first prefrontal lobotomy. By the late 1950s, an estimated 50,000 lobotomies are performed in the United States.
And that's done through the eyeball?
I'll get into what it is because we're going to talk about that.
All right.
So I got a ton of information and I want to get that all for you. So we're gonna continue. We're gonna talk about next episode, the history of asylums, part two. And I'm gonna go through some things like lobotomies that these places used to do. That when I tell you these things, you're gonna be like, what in the world?
But it was 1936.
This is 1936
when the first frontal lobotomy was performed.
1936, the first lobotomy was performed.
Wow.
So all right. All of them done was after 1936.
All right, here we go.
Yeah.
Part two.
So we'll be back, folks. Stick around for your Halloween treats.
Yeah. Those on Facebook Live, stick with us.
Yeah, Facebook Live people, stick with us. Those on listening to the podcast, either jump ahead and join us on the next one or wait till the next Tuesday, Thursday for that episode to drop. In the meantime, change your thinking, change your life, laugh hard, run fast, be kind. We'll see you next time.